Welcome to the East Goes West podcast, where we talk to Asian business leaders about how their companies work and the issues that matter to them. Hosted by Ben de Haldewang and Abhi Pandey. I'm very excited this morning to talk to Martin Lau, who runs the First State team in Hong Kong. First State is one of the larger institutional and retail fund managers in the region. And Martin is the lead manager for a number of very highly rated First State funds, mainly focused on China and the and that part of the Asian region. Trustnet talk about him as consistently performing, or outperforming rather, the peer group, with a focus very much on the stock picking part of the process. Martin was born in Hong Kong in 1972. He graduated from Cambridge with a Bachelor of Arts degree and a Master's in Engineering, and then started in the world of engineering, but decided that that job constrained some of his more natural innovative tendencies. That's not a side to you engineers out there. So moved into the investment world with BZW in 1995 in London as part of their risk management team. Then subsequently spent 6 years with Invesco as a fund manager, responsible for the China funds, and has been at First State since April 2002. First State generally has quite an innovative approach to managing funds, and Martin's philosophy is very much at the heart of that, which is very much bottom-up stock selection with a sort of strong macro overlay. He is very much an anti-benchmark person, and one of the things that I know about First State is that they focus very much on the leadership of the businesses that they invest in, and their ability to manage their companies in a period of transformation and transition. So it's that angle there that I'm particularly interested in exploring with Martin, as someone who has potentially some very significant insight into the way that Asian companies manage their business. So welcome, Martin.
Martin, thank you very much for joining us this this afternoon.
Welcome.
It may be useful just for the audience to get a little bit of sense of your background, how you came to this situation, what factors guided both your career decision and choices, and then a little bit about you know, what you see about the world in your current perch.
That's perfect, Ben. A bit of background about myself. My name is Martin Lau, and I'm the managing partner of First State Stewart, which is actually an investment firm specialized in Asian equities and emerging market equities. My own background is that I joined this fund management industry more than 20 years ago. This is actually my first job and into fund management, and you know, if I'm lucky, probably my last one. So I graduated from the UK. I actually had an engineering degree. So the reason for coming to this industry, when I graduated, I was really looking for an industry which is interesting. To be honest, I didn't find engineering as interesting. And then basically the kind of engineering jobs which I was looking at, you know, actually they're more like following the standards. They're not really innovative type of engineering. I started to look for jobs which kind of involve kind of management, investment, more about people, and at the same time can leverage on my kind of mathematical skills or analytical skills. So I joined the industry more than 20 years ago with a company called LGT, which was basically acquired by Invesco back in 1998. So I joined this company, First State, Stewart of First State Investment, 14 years ago in 2002. And I've always been focused more on Asia, especially on Greater China, because of my own background. And at First Stage, just a bit of background, it might be relevant for later discussion. We really focus on the long term when it comes to investments. In order to focus on long term, our experience is that you really need to focus on the people, because unless you understand the behavior of the people, their philosophy, their risk attitude, their incentives, it is actually quite difficult to take a 5 to 10 year view, because you know, basically you won't be able to predict or guess what the next decision is going to be. So a lot of trust is being put upon those companies that we invest into, the management team. And in a way, the major thing that whenever we invest in a company, the financial statements are important, but more important is the management team, what they have done wrong in the past, what motivates them, and then the alignment with us as minority shareholders. We focus a lot on the incentive scheme as a result, and I think this is also quite interesting when it comes to China, because a lot of the companies are actually owned by the government. So when it comes to the typical kind of Western way of alignment, it may not be the best. So that's not sure about my background. I don't know whether it helps or not.
No, that's perfect. That's perfect. Well, just touching on your background being, from Cambridge, your educational background is very Westernized. What are the skills and what are the things that you had to change, maybe they didn't teach in the CFA program or when you started learning how to invest, that you had to acquire in order to be more effective in terms of evaluating investments in Greater China?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think first of all, if you look at CFA or the financial courses, a lot of the kind of capitalism concept, return on equity, I would say they are largely based on a Western concept of the higher the return, the better. You should maximize shareholder return in a way. A lot of the corporate governance concepts, they are also, originated from the West. Say, for example, the board structure that you need to have, say, in the case of Hong Kong, you need to have at least one third of your board being independent. Your boards, your directors need to be rotated every 3 years. Well, 3 years term at most 3 terms, like maximum 9 years, in order to maintain the kind of independent position. A lot of these are fine, except that when we look into Asia, say China, use China and maybe a bit of Hong Kong and Japan as example, the development of the country is different. For example, a lot of the companies in Asia, they are owned by the families, especially in Hong Kong. So when you talk about the board structure, and we have looked into companies, say, for example, Cheung Kong, which is owned by the Lee family. If you look at the board structure, it wouldn't qualify. In fact, we receive quite a few of reports, corporate governance organization saying that it's actually breaching certain kind of corporate governance criteria. Basically, the board is very old. It's not independent. They've all been around for like 20, 30 years. So you can criticize them from that perspective. But on the other hand, there's a reason for them to do it. I mean, they are, and in a way, they care about the company much more than we do, because they're looking at generations rather than 3 years or three years kind of term for the directors. So how do you adopt, I guess, a certain kind of Western way of looking at companies, which I think is very, very good, into the current stage of development for Asia. Another typical kind of thing for China, for example, if a company is owned by the government, typically the chairman is appointed by the government, the management team is appointed by the government. Often the chairman get rotated, say every 3 to 5 years, and typically if you look at the incentive of the board, the chairman, a typical pay is 500,000 renminbi. This is not even a US dollar, and he has a lot of power and a lot of things, but you cannot really quite explain it from a monetary kind of perspective. Usually they don't own shares, and nor would they be given any shares. So a lot of understanding is really put the first of all the person into the contest, and secondly the company itself into the contest. In China, for example, even for state-owned companies, we have found that they can be very different. Really depending on the history of those state-owned companies. For example, in China, there are three groups of companies or state-owned groups which we always admired. First of all, China Resources Group. Secondly, China Merchants Group, and finally the Sino Group. And you look at the reasons why these groups are better than others, primarily related to the way that these state-owned companies evolves. So, for example, the China Resources Group is actually has its history actually dating back to many like 100 years ago, with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Economic Trade and Foreign Affairs. So they really have a very long history of dealing with foreigners, being open to competition. Their mindset is quite westernized, even though they're still subject to a lot of Chinese kind of rules when it comes to incentives. So, again, if you use a Western way of, you know, scoring, putting a scorecard on the board structure, the incentives and things, they won't necessarily score very high. But if you look at the track record and the management, the decisions in the past, they have done a lot better than other Chinese state-owned companies. So I think you need to put it the Asian, you know, history, context, the family background into account rather than just saying, you know, this is the way that you should do things.
So, Martin, that's really interesting. I suppose I'm tempted to ask the question, why do you think they've done so well? Obviously, Abe, from a, you know, and both of us, I suppose, from a Western perspective, would look at that and say, you're right, you know, that doesn't make any sense. So why have they been successful in the context of the market they've operated in, given the fact that they don't necessarily conform to the perspective of governance that, you know, perhaps looks like best practice elsewhere?
Yeah, I think the way that a company evolves is very important. So my own view is if a company evolves under a protected environment, and there are plenty of state-owned companies in China which has evolved under a protected environment, you know, for example, PetroChina, you know, you can argue China Mobile, you know, you can hardly say you are genuinely competitive if you've always been protected. However, in certain industries, if you are brought up, you know, usually with a very humble background, you really need to compete for very limited resources. Need to compete with foreigners, which in the case of China Resources and China Merchants, actually run the, you know, for example, the ships, and then deal with foreigners back to the Qing Dynasty. You know, your DNA tend to be more kind of open and also more competitive. If you look at CNOOC, the difference between CNOOC and PetroChina, when CNOOC was founded, you know, there was the time when China really had no money. So basically the government said, I want you to develop the offshore China, you know, oil fields. Sorry, we don't have any money. And off you go. And as a result, they've over the years, they've formed a lot of joint ventures, cooperations with the Western or, you know, global oil majors into development all these oil fields. They were brought up with a very limited kind of capital and therefore has always been very focused on return. And again, if you compare this, you know, again say PetroChina, I mean the mindset when it comes to return is just very, very different. The mindset when it comes to cost management is also very different. So both are owned by the government, owned by the central government, both does oil exploration. If you look at the return on equity, the cost per barrel, you know, cash flow generation, they are very, very different. So again, I mean, history explains a lot of it.
Very interesting indeed. So if you look at the leadership then of some of these companies that have done really well and the management teams in particular, let's just talk about maybe one or two aspects of the way that they run their businesses, perhaps, you know, the way they make decisions or the way that they receive feedback from the marketplace. Are there any things in those processes that are, you know, quite unique or things that you would look for to say, OK, this is really the sign of a business that's doing it in the right way?
Yeah, that's a very good one. Yeah, first of all, sometimes you relate, companies management, they're still human beings, like fund managers, we're all human beings. Human beings will be influenced by what's going on today. Say, for example, you can say a fund manager should always, you know, buy at the bottom and sell at the peak, but most fund managers or investors actually do the reverse. So I think when we look into people or when into companies management, we like people who always think about what could go wrong when things are rosy, and similarly they always think maybe things are not as bad, or you know they're you know brave enough to take a contrarian view when things are really bad. So I think these are as a nutshell, would be the things that we want to see. Usually, especially for emerging markets, because and emerging markets, for some reason, most people believe there's always growth. Management tend to be more to the optimistic side. So if you look at, if you meet up with an Indian company, they would be telling you that, you know, growth would be like 20% for the next 10 years. Korean companies, they always look to double capacity. Chinese companies, depending on which industry you're looking at, we've done this exercise before. What's your target market share? They always target market share which is higher than their current market share. And if you add up all the target market shares, they add up to more than 100, which means they all look to build capacity much more than is necessary. This is China. So I, if you look at Japan, they tend to be much more conservative. Well, since they've been beaten by 25 years of recession, so I think the mentality is different. And we like companies which can take somewhat a contrarian view. And I mentioned about Hong Kong, for example. One of the things, for example, some of these family-owned companies. And there are quite a few of these, like Tata in India, yeah. Hong Kong in Hong Kong, SM Group in Philippines, etc. Because they take such a long-term view, and this actually allow them to take a different view when everyone is not brave enough to take those views. So again, if you compare with American companies and professionally managed, yes, they maximize profit. They try to, do all the kind of right things. But then, in a way, they don't have the luxury of many kind of family-owned companies in Asia to take such a long view, long-term view. So I think the ability to take to think about risk when things are good, and then the ability to think about what they could actually buy when things are bad is very, very important.
So, Martin, what's your, one of the reasons why we set this podcast up was to talk about, Chinese capital flowing westwards and companies in the States and Europe now being owned by Chinese businesses. And one of the interests that I was trying to explore was what's that going to feel like for a European or American company in terms of the new leadership style, in terms of the expectations around what good might look like, in terms of, the way they're going to influence those businesses. Do you have some sense or some perspectives on that? What do you think might be expected?
Yes, that's a good one. But first of all, as a rule of thumb, we do believe Chinese would increasingly acquire overseas. If you rather simplistically, the way that we look at it is for the last say 10, 20 years, China is an exporter of goods, so they manufacture all the shoes and garments and things for the rest of the world. For the next 15 to 20 years, China would become more an exporter of capital, in a way similar to what Japan has done when you build up your after manufacturing, build up your wealth, and you have a lot of capital, you start to invest overseas. And I think this is a long-term trend, and we've seen that already happening. So far, I think from the investment community perspective, whenever a company in China acquires overseas, I think people would usually take it with a pinch of salt. And the reason for that is, culturally, people see it as a very different. And if it is done by a state-owned company, then there's a natural suspicion that state-owned company is doing for national service. And historically, if you look at the large-scale acquisition by Chinese overseas, they have not been that successful. Examples would include, Lenovo buying IBM, which was quite ill-timed, even though subsequently it did very well. TCL bought Thomson, which is the TV business in Europe, bought Alcatel for the smartphone, or then there wasn't even a smartphone for a phone business, which basically disappeared. I said they are very, very good. They actually bought Nexon, which is the AllSense company in Canada, right at the very peak. Recently, Haier bought the GE household appliance business, from GE, and people said basically they overpaid. So I think if you go down the list, there are actually quite a few suspicion or not so good examples. On the other hand, we have also seen a few good ones. If you look at, I was in Germany for example, 2 weeks ago, and I saw so many, when I visited some companies and clients, in quite a number of office buildings, you actually see quite a lot of Chinese on directories. So a lot of Chinese companies have gone to Germany to acquire companies or set up offices, because for China, one of the things that Chinese companies want to look for is technology. In Germany is pretty good with technology. So we've seen, for example, Minc, which is an auto component company, acquiring in Germany and set up a production base in Germany, has actually done okay, reasonably well. We've seen Wei Chai Power also acquiring in Europe. They acquired Linde, which is the kind of pneumatic kind of component, and has done also quite well. And we've seen, last year we've also seen Delta Electronics acquire Eltec, which is a telecom power company, and has done, still early days, but seems to have done reasonably well. So I think there's also some successful examples. I think this is a kind of ongoing process. We've also looked into Japan. If you look at Japan, over the last, 20-25 years, Japan, when the economy was very, very strong in the 80s, the Japanese were also acquiring globally as if there's no tomorrow. So they acquired properties, hotels, companies, more or less like the Chinese people have done. Many of them didn't succeed. But if you look at Japan, actually quite a lot of companies over the last 20, 30 years, they have actually established quite decent global presence.
So Martin, to the question about success or not success, what determines that success then in your mind? Is it the smart decision about which companies to buy or the sectors they're operating in, or is it something around the leadership style and the things they're trying to drive through from that perspective? I was trying to get under the heart of what you think is going to was going to determine whether this works or not as they expand overseas.
Yeah, well, my own experience is, it's a learning process. If I take Minc, an example, we've been shareholders of Minc for more than 10 years. When they first acquired in Thailand, it wasn't very successful. This Thailand in Asia, it wasn't very successful. And in fact, today it's still not successful. It is an auto component company. So China is a big auto market. And they've been trying to expand to the US, Germany, and Southeast Asia, which are like the other big car markets. So I think the strategy makes sense. I think for the last 10 years, they make mistakes. And I think generally we prefer companies to kind of like, do something and learn at the same time. Vis-a-vis, for example, when Sinok bought X, and I mean, of course, with hindsight, the oil price was too high, and TCL buying Thomson and Elica, it's kind of a big shot in one go, big acquisition. If you're acquiring simply for the scale, I think, especially when it is a very big scale, I think the risk would be a lot higher. We look at synergies. For example, higher when they announced the acquisition of GE Household Appliance, I think the market was very skeptical. The share price fell like 10-20%. I talked to the company recently, and as I start to understand their thinking and also understand the industry a bit more, I think the risk is actually quite okay. I think it's also a function of the industry. I think for Chinese to succeed in acquiring overseas, I think preferably you want to have something which is, I wouldn't call it commoditized, but not as fast changing. For example, household appliance, washing machine, water heaters, they're the same washing machine, water heaters in China. They got the scale, they know how to do it, and the products wouldn't change that quickly anyway. Vis-a-vis buying a smartphone company, say Lenovo, also buying Motorola, which now everybody believes it was a mistake. And the kind of market environment just changes so quickly. I think Chinese probably would be better still, as of today, with businesses which are more driven by cost competitiveness rather than genuine brand building, cutting edge technology, because China is far from that.
Got it. No, I mean, I get the sense. So from your perspective, just to encapsulate, sort of small M&A where mistakes won't necessarily cost the company too much tends to be better than big M&A. and sort of cost, anything that enhances cost competitiveness is better than prestige brands or fast moving.
Crown jewels.
Okay. No, that's very helpful. But let me just touch on, so we've been talking about, you know, Greater China and expansion abroad. Similarly, one of the things that's been very fascinating you hear about is a lot of Western money taking positions in Asian businesses. Specifically, I'm referring to, for example, a number of the activist hedge funds who are taking positions in Japanese and Korean businesses. Is this a trend that you see? Is sort of investor activism something that you see is likely to grow, or is this something that's a uniquely U.S. phenomenon that sort of only works with in a sort of Western context?
That's a good question. I think it depends. My own observation and experience is that, for example, in Korea and Japan, shareholder kind of activism hasn't really worked. In many ways, it's backfired. And for example, in Korea, some activists was trying to block, fight against the Samsung, restructuring what happened was, the domestic investors also voted for Samsung. If you look at Korea, it may not be fair for the Korean people, but the general sentiment is still pretty much kind of patriotism and a little bit anti-foreigner to some extent. And I think if you are too high profile and too strong, often, you won't succeed. And there have been, in the past, there have actually been one or two successful cases, Korean First Bank and the private equity bought into it and made a lot of money. And the government, subsequently chased after the private equity for the tax and things. And so I think, in the case of Korea and Japan, my own observation is that, because of their very unique kind of tradition and also the kind of, culture due to some history, they tend to be much more against kind of very aggressive kind of activism. On the other hand, I mean, because we are shareholders too, we like engaging with companies. But then if you are really kind of long-term and you've been a shareholder for a long term and you try to kind of help, with the attitude of trying to help the companies in terms of some suggestions, often the attitude is a very positive one. For example, in Japan, we've been a shareholder of a company called Pigeon, which sells brand bottles, etc. So, it's clear to them, dividend payout, this is, what you can do and should do. They actually listen. So I think in the case of Korea, in Japan, I think if you take a softer stance, a more longer term stance, I think companies they do listen.
What about China? For
the state owned companies, I don't think you can be an activist anyway, because the government owns much more than you. So we haven't really seen that many kind of activism when it comes to state-owned companies. There have been quite a number of private equity taking meaningful stakes in companies, trying to help them to improve their corporate governance image or the or overall international strategy. So, for example, Hire KKR they own actually 10% of Hire. If you look at Midi. Maybe actually also CDH, which is another private equity actually own a stake, and so I think if you look at and Lenovo in the past, also some private equity having a stake. So I think the private equity, some of them actually help some of the more private companies that they grow over the years, give them some advice, and also give them, in the case of Hire, the international strategy of how they should expand, what kind of candidates they should look at. There have been some, I wouldn't say very good examples, but better examples with private companies rather than state-owned companies.
Right.
Martin, we're almost at the end, but I've got a couple more questions for you. The first one is, you know, obviously one of the things that we've seen in Asia is this sort of generational shift that's taking place from, you know, from the older generation that perhaps were the pioneers that set some of these businesses up to now a more Western educated, you know, youth that have come through. In your observations around the way that those businesses are run, have you seen some changes as a consequence of that?
Yes, I think to different degrees. I think first of all, as you probably know, there's a Chinese saying, or actually this saying is the same for quite a lot of countries. Usually, you know, the founders founded the company, the second generation kind of keep it, and the third generation kind of ruin it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of truth in it. So the first generation, and usually they are much less polished, much less educated. They're usually more aggressive. They take more risk, and in a way, because they've taken the right risk, they founded a lot of wealth. And usually the second generation, and there's so many examples, usually they are very, very well educated, you know, all the right kind of universities, MBAs, and you know, usually worked in an investment bank for a few years before they, you know, accountants and consultants and before they took over their family businesses. But usually they're slightly less aggressive, probably more Western in terms of forming the board and having all these kind of right people around him. You know, probably unfair, but probably works less hard. And because they you know, they haven't gone through the same kind of tough period in their life. So we've seen that different, and also different countries, they have different stage. They're in different stages in terms of generation. For example, in Hong Kong, I think we are by and large from the first to second, even though there's some exceptions. So Cheung Kong, again, using this as example, is first to second, and I think it has been quite successful. Whereas in some other countries like India, you know, much longer, they probably will be fourth generation, fifth generation, Japan even more so, and Philippines, you know, etc. So we've seen different. One good example could be just, you know, this is not China, but if you look at Philippines, there are two big groups. One is the SM Group, which is owned by the C family, and the other is the Ayala Group, which is owned by the Ayala family. Ayala, I think they're into the seventh or eighth generation, and C is still with their first, second generation. And if you look at the two groups, they're both very good companies. The behaviors are quite different. You know, right. SM is much more aggressive, and Ayala is much more kind of corporate governance, board decision driven kind of company. So again, I think they're in different stages of development.
Got it. That's very interesting. Well, any other questions?
I had a sort of a broad question, which is, you know, for people who are listening in Europe and the States to this, they will have a perception of Asia, which is broadly based on a series of stereotypes. I'd be interested in which one you'd, I suppose, be most interested in getting rid of. Which stereotype do you think is the most insidious and perhaps the most wrong in the way it delivers?
On Asia, right?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, I think the first of all, when we talk to investors from US, Europe, they have a certain, as you said, the kind of perception on Asian companies or Chinese companies. One thing is they may think, partly because the sentiment on China is not so good, and they tend to have some imaginations on Chinese companies, say, you know, with state-owned companies, etc. And secondly, they also, in my view, they also take, partly because they're so far away, they often take a more top-down view or macro view on China. So you know, because the newspaper is talking about all the ghost towns in China, all the overinvestments and L-shaped recovery and all those, they would tend to take the whole China or emerging markets at a basket case. Mm. My own kind of view, and we have always a negative on China, and we do believe it's a not a quite a nice economy. But then from a bottom up perspective, you know, within a big country, there are actually quite a lot of interesting companies with interesting people, interesting business models. A lot of these companies, they are founded by people who return from the U.S. and you know engineers and things. So I think the kind of basket case is stereotyping Chinese companies, taking a very top down view, is one of the, you might be one of the general kind of practice by U.S. or European investors, and that also opens up opportunities. My own view is when things are good, China or emerging markets Asia, they're actually not as good as you think. And similarly, when things are really bad, maybe they are not as bad as you think. Just like when I talk about companies, what we try to do is take a more balanced view. When things are really horrible, we maybe tend to think about maybe things are not as horrible as you think, and try to find some interesting companies. When companies are in very hot demand and everyone believes China is great, beautiful, maybe China is not as great and beautiful as you think, and try to reduce some of the risk.
Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Martin. This has been extraordinarily interesting.
Yeah, thank you, Ben, and thank you for having me.
Great chat. That's brilliant. We will send it over to you when it's done.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
And have a nice afternoon.
Bye.
Bye, cheers. Bye-bye.
So, Ali, I saw you getting very excited in this call because I think it suits your natural skill set.
I love finance and investing, so this is right down my alley.
Absolutely. So what did you get out of this, other than a few good tips?
Yeah, if only you'd given tips. No, you know, I think that I've always been skeptical around the value of corporate culture in determining companies. And I think what Martin did is he didn't get into the truly soft and fuzzy, looking at, you know, flat organizations or not, but more focused on what I appreciate, the aspects of corporate culture that are important, being, which is sort of, are incentives aligned? Are people thinking in the right time horizons? And, you know, one of the things I'd always assumed, and I think this is a debate that you and I have, I always assumed that sort of the Asian way, whether it's the Indian or the Chinese or the Japanese, is probably not as efficient as the Western way of having a professional board. And the one thing he said that was gave me some pause was that he said, look, when you own the company, you can afford to think in 50, 100-year increments or longer-term increments, even 10 or 15 years, that a board member who's got a three-year horizon will just simply not make.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, we've talked about in the past that the pay differential between top and bottom, I think, is a very insidious thing that's slightly different over here. And he, to some extent, confirmed that as well, which I thought was interesting.
The chairman not making 500,000 renminbi.
Correct, exactly. You know, which is just an unbelievably small amount of money for the size of businesses they are from a Western perspective. I think, but equally, to give him his credit, he also talked about the fact that, you know, what he was looking for in the leadership teams was their ability to manage risk. Now that fits very comfortably in many parts of the world, not just here.
I like the fact that he talked about, he distinguished between state-owned enterprises in China that he liked and ones he didn't, and defining that as he liked the ones that were left out in the cold to fend for themselves in the past when China didn't have a lot of money and therefore became efficient because they were sort of forged in the crucible of the global markets, and the guys who were protected in a domestic market got fat and happy and are emerged less competitive. And I thought that was an interesting insight.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fascinating because, it shows a similar sort of rigor, you know, which you perhaps admire in a Western business as well. You know, that willingness to stay with it, to manage your business very closely and very tightly. You know, and I think, you know, going back to our initial scenario, which is what is it going to feel like to be bought by one of these businesses, that probably is going to feel, you know, probably as uncomfortable as being bought by another, you know, Western business that's going to be very tight on cost and everything else that goes
on. I wonder whether if you're a European company, would you rather be bought by a Chinese company, which at some level, and we've had, this has been something we've had conversations around in the past, has a respect for history, has a respect for culture, as opposed to an American company whose first response is, what's unbolted that I can sell to get my costs back? I mean, the sort of hyper-efficient, down-to-the-bones approach that the Americans have versus the longer-term-oriented and more respective of cultural norms, potentially, that the Chinese have the capacity to, at least in their own environment, have.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a good challenge, isn't it? And those things will evolve as the companies. You know, I love the fact he was very honest about, you know, some of the failures that Chinese and Asian companies have had in terms of their moves overseas. You know, and the reality is that, certainly from my own experience, that this is a learning exercise. You know, if you can learn, you know, my biggest bugbear in terms of M&A is that companies fail to learn from their previous experiences. But it looks like, you know, he talks about you're going for, you know, commoditized businesses that are quite cost conscious. Those are the ones you want to go for, not the sort of high glamour ones.
I think and the smaller is better.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read a book a long time ago called what is it called? Small Tests.
Yeah.
Is that the one? Where, you know, the author basically talks about the merits of sort of not incrementalist approach, but doing small experiments as a process for learning and getting better rather than taking one big shot that sort of either will result in a, you know, catastrophic failure or a big success.
My last thing that I thought was fascinating, and it was came out very early on in the conversation, we've touched on a little bit, was the subject of governance. Yeah, and he said, look, if you look at this, if you look at Chinese or Hong Kong-based companies from the perspective of supposed best practice in the West, you're going to look at the government structure and say that doesn't work. You know, but he said, but maybe that's just different. Maybe that is actually fundamentally different from the way that we run things over here.
But, you know, he did bring up the fault line in that, which is take for example some of these Hong Kong founder-led companies. As long as the founder is involved and his peers or her peers are involved, I think you're right, because they founded the company, they have a 30-year perspective, they're willing to forego short-term profits for long-term benefits. But at the same time, and some of the examples of the companies, CKI being one of them, the transition to the next generation has been disastrous because they always insist on handing over power to somebody's kids. Those kids fight among each other, fight with the parents, have totally different set of values, and may not, in fact, be interested in a 30-year perspective. A professionally run company doesn't have that problem, right? You can have transitions of board members. If everybody has a 5-year perspective, at least you have sort of a rolling 5-year, and it provides the potential for less instability.
I would argue with you on a couple of things on that. Firstly, I think that corporate history is not a very positive one, and that the numbers of companies that have lasted for a very long time is quite limited. So I think there's still some learning around that process. We haven't got the right model yet. I think, but the second thing that I'd say, and this is perhaps where Asia is different, is because, you know, these sort of family squabbles that take place in every family-run company typically take place in a European context in a sort of Mittelstand company that no one's ever heard of, right?
Right.
Yeah? What we're talking about here are massive enterprises in the context of the economy, yeah, which are still family-owned.
Right.
And so we're watching these fights take place in a very, very public place, yeah?
Okay.
And that's, I think, fascinating. That's really interesting, isn't it?
Because, it is. It's definitely, it's awesome to follow on the news. I guess my question is, for a company that big, does having this type of family squabble and the intergenerational transfers cause more instability than if the founder, much like take Microsoft or Apple, had basically handed management over professional and put a professional board in place? Bill Gates' kids don't run Microsoft or have any influence, and neither do Steve Jobs' family in Apple. Is that the better transition? So it is true in both Apple and Microsoft's case. They had founders who had long-term visions, who were willing to forego short-term profits, much like me. But, you know, is there greater wisdom in not having this transfer down the family chain? And at some point, you just hand it over to a professionally run system?
You know, it's a good discussion to have because, you know, in lots of these, even in the companies that have gone from pure family ownership to part listing, the listing's still small. You know, so the fiduciary responsibility is actually as much to the family as it is to external shareholders. In fact, you know, and I think it's a criticism that's been aimed at a lot of Asian businesses in the past, which is they don't really care about their external shareholders because it's such a small representation of the business. And maybe that transition takes place, if it ever takes place, as those shareholding, those listings become larger. And there's a less of a sort of family involvement in that process.
Right.
Maybe that's the transition we're looking at.
Interesting. Fantastic. Take care.